Welcome to the Chariot TechCast, episode number 111, our interview with Philly emerging tech speaker Jessica Kerr. I'm TechCast producer Becca Refford. The Chariot TechCast is brought to you by Chariot Solutions. For help developing great software, whether it's in the cloud, native apps in iOS or Android, browser-based single-page apps in React or Angular, moving big data around, or even integrating IoT devices with your data collection services and sensors, Chariot is here to help. We provide project-based consulting, training, mentoring, and architectural evaluations to make your efforts shine. Visit us on the web at chariotsolutions.com. In this episode, host Ken Rimple talks to Jessica Kerr about how we work with software and how Atomist, the automation tool that she engineers, makes delivery that much easier. They discuss the current state of open source, making sense of documentation, and why software is such an exciting field to be in right now. Jessica also shares some of the insights she's gleaned from working out loud and solving software problems in real time on her Twitch stream. Jessica is bookending this year's Philly ETE conference. She's our first day keynote speaker and is doing another talk as well there. Come see both of them. Her keynote is called Collective Problem Solving: Music, Science, and Software. The other talk she'll be doing also centers on collaboration, called Principles of Collaborative Automation. She's an ETE veteran, so if you've seen her there before, you know what a compelling speaker she is. Now, onto the TechCast.
So thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So we've got, first of all, I went to do a little research, and I know you've spoken at ETE a number of times, and you work on Atomist, which we could talk about. But I just did a little Google search, and I ran into your Twitch stream. I think that's awesome. How long have you been doing that?
Just a few months.
Uh-huh.
It's new this year, and oh my gosh, it helps me so much. Mostly it just keeps me focused.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what do you do, like pair programming and things like that a lot with it? Or?
And my default is whatever I'm working on that day, I'll just stream it. It also gives me an excuse to work on code instead of just documentation, because documentation is just, But the pairing thing, I find I like that more and more, that it's really fun to pair on stream.
What are the insights you've gotten from, you know, doing this kind of thing on the video stream? First of all, you're live. Second of all, you know, like you can't edit yourself really, right?
Yeah, but editing is so much work. I mean, that's the benefit, is that I can't edit it, so I never have to.
It's kind of a freedom, you know? So let's talk a little bit about you. So how did you get your start in software development?
A million years ago in college, my aunt's friend got me a summer internship doing programming at FedEx and operations research. And I discovered that coding is easy. It's fun. I got to make maps. I got to work with like a GIS system. That was fun. And then at 5:30, you go home and there's no homework. It's amazing. And you can get a job in any city. And yeah, I was like, wow, this is way better than academia, because I was studying physics, and the physics is a great lead into 1,000 different careers.
Yeah.
As a career in itself.
Oh my gosh. In academia or research, and then try to find a gig, and it's hard.
Yeah, you just have to really be passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So ironically, in the beginning, I got into programming because it was like 9 to 5, and then I didn't have to think about it after work. Of course, now I'm thinking about it constantly.
Yeah. Well, as you get really like advanced in your career and work long enough, things start swirling around in your head, right? Like things bug you.
And our field is just so fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, to be in software right now is spectacular.
It's never boring. It might be maddening, but it's never really boring.
Yeah. If it's boring, you're doing something wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. So like, I know my area that I'm working on right now is all front end stuff. So I do my trainings in Angular and React. And so I've been the one here kind of as a catalyst to get things rolling with that a couple of years back. And so now we're doing a number of those projects. But now my research and my talk for ETE is on GraphQL. It's kind of neat, isn't it? Yeah. So the thing is, what you find, and you'll probably find the same thing, as you start working with different APIs, it's kind of like a guessing game. You know, you pick the ones you think they're really good, you start working on the code, and then eventually you might hit a blind alley where something's supposed to work and it just doesn't, no matter what you try to do.
Yeah, and then what do you do?
Right. So I mean, how many times have you gone down a road with a particular open source project and had to like turn left and switch to something else? I mean, it seems like it's a lot for me.
Yeah, a couple times. Yeah, and it boils down to, can you get help? Can you figure out what you're doing? I'm working, this is extremely relevant to like what I'm doing today, which is I'm writing documentation for Atomist, and I'm like, okay, I want to get it to deploy to my own Kubernetes cluster and write that up. And I've got the instructions written up, but can I get them to work? That's another question. Yeah. And then when it doesn't work, what do I do? And I post in our Atomist Slack, and our VP of engineering and our infrastructure person pop in. They're like, oh, well, check this on Kubernetes, check that on Kubernetes. And I'm like, how? What? Or occasionally it's worse. Look in the logs.
Right.
Do I have access to those logs? Well, okay, actually, in this case, as a human, I do. It's my own Kubernetes logs. But how would I know to do that? And how can I find out whether it worked? And this is one reason I volunteered to be in charge of the documentation, because documentation is kind of a proxy for users. Yeah. If you can't explain it succinctly, maybe it's time to rethink the API. Yeah. So I'm always pushing back on, okay, when someone gets stuck, how do they figure out the next step?
That's a good point. I find with a lot of these open source projects now, front end, have you seen that picture going around about a full stack developer and it's a horse?
Which one?
That's my favorite one. I have to put it up on the podcast feed, but it's like the horse is beautifully drawn from the rear to like the two thirds, and then it's a stick figure in the front. And it just feels like that every time I do anything on the front end. I'm like, now is this the time I'm going to find a library that either A, doesn't have any tests against it, B, doesn't have any documentation, C, the documentation is out of date, D, the project has been abandoned. Like it's I'm specifically writing to this, like, for example, in the React world, right? React is this tiny little core of a JavaScript library, which is really beautiful in and of itself. And I think Redux is a common thing you hook up to it as a really nice state machine. But all the stuff around it, it's a Wild West. And people will pick very, very official sounding names for their project. And you dig a little bit and you find out, oh, it's really two developers and 10 commits. And they stopped 3 years ago.
Right. Oh, yeah. I was just reading a blog post by Steve Klabnik like 10 minutes ago about like open source and like what's the future and what's because really when we talk about an open source project, we have way more expectations than you can use the code. You expect a community. You expect bug trackers and mailing lists. You expect documentation. You expect Stack Overflow answers. You expect to be able to participate in the development if you choose. Every piece of software, with an asterisk, there are exceptions. Every piece of software is so much more than the code. And you can get the code to any of these libraries and you can start using it. And then it doesn't work. And then what? If that community doesn't exist, if you can't tap into the documentation and the mailing list and the Slack and whatever, then you have to become that community.
Yep.
You have to figure it out yourself and read all the code and good freaking luck with that.
And you're like Poirot, you know, you're trying to solve the murder mystery and you find out that you're on the wrong train and you have to get up and move to another train.
And at that point, it is easier to write it yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. So how do you guys keep your documentation up to date? How do you keep on top of it? Because that's a real challenge.
Yeah, well, we don't as well as we should. So, I mean, there's an infinite amount of things that I still want to document or document better. But we just try to prioritize by what people really need. My other philosophy is if someone contributes, and various people in Atomist do contribute to the documentation, if it's better, merge it.
Yeah, right.
There is no perfect. Mm-hmm. And by better, I mean, no document is better than inaccurate.
True.
Accurate is better than nothing. Complete is better than accurate. Mm-hmm. And then we can start worrying about tone and whether it looks pretty. So a constant improvement. It just has to be a continual cycle. And you can't wait until it's perfect to push it out there.
Right.
Speaking of which, even though I haven't got this working locally, I should just push it to production. The documentation, because it would, for instance, work with someone who happened to run more than one node on their tiny personal Kubernetes instance. That's what I ran into today.
Now you know. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Just continual small improvement.
As here I am complaining, but like, what do I contribute to open source? Like, that's part of the problem with open source is there's so few people actually doing the work compared to the people, you know, pulling the work that, you know, you also get that kind of guilt of, well, I don't want to push too hard because I know these people are doing this on their spare time. And
yeah, it's like the yoga people. I mean, is it better that they did something and don't have time to update it?
Right.
If they had never done it at all. It's better that they did something. See, this is why I like streaming on Twitch, because there's no expectation of editing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's done. It's out there. You get what you get.
Right. And then you can come back a couple of years later and say, we should resurrect this thing because it was really useful. And now we're kind of in a more stable state to make version 2 of this thing because the framework we're built on is now more stable.
Yeah. At some point it becomes worth investing more time in particular topics, but you don't know what those topics are immediately.
Yeah. Is Atomist somewhat open source or is it more closed source? I don't know.
Atomist has a lot of open source. So Atomist like gives you a framework to write your own software delivery system. So like treat it like an application and write tests and use a real programming language and make it work both with your legacy code. But then you can also change it when you want to move to a new environment in one place instead of 1,000,000,000 Jenkins files. And all of that. So we provide code that you run on your infrastructure. And you modify when you create your delivery with Atomist, you start with a fork of our open source, pretty much a clone. But it's different from running in someone else's platform. It's like give you the basis to create your platform. So all that stuff is open source, which is fantastic because that's why I can stream my work on Twitch, because all the projects that I'm changing are open source. Mm-hmm. And then we have a service that does triggering and graph data correlation and provides a GraphQL API and stuff like that. That part is not open source, but that's okay. I don't work on that part. So my GitHub graph for the last 2 years looks spectacular.
Yeah, it's all open source. So you're someone's cloning it, right? So they're basically taking it at a particular time of commit. How do people then get up to date again? So is it just that what they're cloning is kind of the workflow and configuration parts of it, and they use libraries that are published that they can upgrade? Or
Yeah. A lot of it, there's a framework and libraries, also open source, that you can upgrade within your software delivery machine, we call it. And so you can upgrade the libraries, and we have to keep those backwards compatible. And then, now someday, we haven't had a need to do this yet, but Atomist also part of what we provide and what our open source stuff provides is code to modify code. So if I ever do want to, change the usage of something, if I can write a program to change the code in the right way, which I often can, then I can give you that. Then you can get automatic pull requests.
You know, it's interesting that the Angular team started doing this a bit and some other JavaScript.
Oh, yeah.
They call them schematics. I don't know if that's the term that you use for them.
We call them code transforms.
Code transforms, yeah. So I don't know if the schematic is their term, but basically you can run schematics and have it upgrade the way you're using a particular library, the methods change, and kind of transform the code. And I think React does this too. There's like in the JavaScript world, there's a whole bunch of discussion about dealing with the this keyword, right? So because, it's based on where you're running at the time. So this changes out from under you and it's empty and things blow up. And so the JavaScript community has been changing a lot of how you write code that's this compliant, so to speak, that preserves the this keyword for you. So arrow functions and then arrow mm-hmm. methods and all sorts of goofy things like that. And when the React team came up with their ways of doing that, they put out some of these schematic type things to kind of upgrade your code for you so you can use the current idiom, which is kind of interesting.
Excellent. Yeah, those are really interesting to write. It really makes you think deeply about your code and the structure of it and what it really means and what really matters. It's much harder to write a code transform than to do the same change in 8 different places by hand.
Yeah.
But it's so much more fun.
So are you parsing that with like an Antler type parser, or like what kind of other higher level APIs around that you take advantage of that keyword everything and tokenize everything?
There's different levels. Mm-hmm. So at one level, yes, Antler. Mm-hmm. And we, Rod Johnson, yeah. Made a library that kind of wraps Antler. And so if there's an Antler parser, then you can use kind of XPath expressions to find the bits in the tree that you want and update them in place.
Oh, that's very cool.
Which is important. So it doesn't change your spacing. It doesn't change your comments. It just updates the code right in place. And that's if there's a good parser for your language. Mm-hmm. Not only Antler, TypeScript has a great parser.
Yeah.
And then at another level, at the opposite extreme, you can just do string replacements or regex replacements. Regex works for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But then in between, we also have a library, which I'm extremely fond of, which is called Microgrammars.
Mm-hmm.
And Rod implemented this based on some paper. And it's kind of like regular expressions, except composable, and you can give things real names and you can embed code in it.
Oh, that's really neat.
Match, and it's like modular and expandable, but it can be just barely a tiny layer on regular expressions if that's what you need. Those are very flexible because they let you write a halfway decent parser, but only for the piece of code you're interested in. So like regular expressions, it's not going to try to parse the whole file. It's just going to identify pieces that match the pattern you asked for. But like an Antler parser, you get to break that down into little pieces. And so it's not just groups, which are marked with secret parentheses. But
yeah, that's regex.
Parts. Yeah, and the different parts can have their substructure. And then you can update those parts by name.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, it converts it into an object structure. And then you can update that object structure and apply those updates to the file.
So like a composable DSL for regex, kind of, in a way.
Yeah, for parsing parts of files,
mm-hmm.
not for having to understand the whole flippin' language.
Right, right, right. Well, because also, I mean, someone using regex, they can do a real, a whole bunch of selectors that don't match a darn thing, or or put the wrong things in the wrong place, or screw everything up.
Oh, they're so hard.
They're evil, I think. But they're the evil we need sometimes. So what are you going to do, you know?
The evil we need.
We need some evil. Let's make it regular expressions.
I'm gonna tweet that.
Well, thank you. So let's talk more about Atomist specifically. Like, how would you describe Atomist in a quick napkin discussion?
That's really hard because it is kind of a level. So the problem is, as developers, we need more automation of our own work, and we need custom automation of our own work, especially software delivery, because as we get more and more projects, and it's not just 5 repos now, it's 100. And how do you get those into production in a way that's consistent with your particular business needs?
So like, for example, moving it from level to level, staging it, cutting a release, rolling back a release.
Yeah, whatever it is you need to do, people get excited about, like Spinnaker or something, where Netflix has built their own custom deployment system and you can use it, but you're not Netflix. You don't need their custom deployment system, but we do need more control over that. And we need to apply it at an organizational level, not repo by repo. And we don't want to do it in YAML and Bash.
Right.
You know, I learned Bash 20 years ago. It was super useful. I used it all the time to script my own stuff. I still script my own stuff, and that's great. But I'm sorry, if you can't get your software into production without this Bash script, that Bash script is production code.
That's true.
And does it have tests? No, of course it doesn't have tests. It's a Bash script.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So Atomist lets you define all that stuff in code that you can write tests around,
mm-hmm.
like in TypeScript, which is a great language. And then connect to an API that deals with all the common stuff that everybody needs to do. Like, hey, trigger this every push. And I'm going to need you to have cloned the repo. And then I'm going to want to make commits to the repo, possibly. That's something that most CI doesn't do easily. And then you can put in one place what you want to happen, the steps, and add approval buttons and who needs to click approval. And you get chat integration and a web interface. And just kind of like, we give you all the pieces and some examples and let you build your own tools. I have a new theory about it. I'm just uh-huh. trying this one out.
All right, go ahead. No one's going to listen to this.
You know how...
Shh, go ahead.
You know how...
Go ahead, yeah.
But Feathers posted something about this the other day. Michael Feathers tweeted mm-hmm. something, somebody else's article, about how you can have a tiny team of small talk developers that just outperform whole enterprises. Mm-hmm. And it's because their tools are custom, because they're constantly like modifying their IDE as they go. Some people do this with Emacs.
Low
and
friction. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they're constantly reducing friction and making their own work easier. Their very particular work, not their work generically. They're mm-hmm. not designing a programming language, just a single purpose DSL at every level. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but that doesn't scale. It doesn't scale out.
Right.
I think Atomist is one way, kind of like Emacs is for an individual. Atomist can be for your organization, because it lets you make the automations that your organization needs to make the right thing easy. Project creation becomes a lot easier and simpler, and you can get it right. And then also project modification and looking at all your projects and saying who uses this version of what. You can write little tiny functions for that, like you would in Emacs, except it works at an organizational level. It is available in chat, and I can make automations that help people learn how to use stuff. I want my delivery system to teach people how we deliver software in this organization, so that when they join and they use it, it's not like magic behind the scenes, but it's right in front of them where they can see it happen.
That's a really cool theory, by the way. I like that. Yeah, use that. What is your getting started story for someone who's coming in and getting involved? So they clone the repo, they start playing around. Like, how do people get going? Do you have a nice tutorial out there? Do people usually join the Slack or some sort of like, you know, message board or?
Good question. There are some getting started flows which result in kind of like a little demo. Mm-hmm. You get a demo project delivered, and then you can create SDM and fork it and do what you want with it. Mm-hmm. Some of the easy getting started things are add a Slack command. Mm-hmm. It's really easy. Oh, project generation is another really good one, because kind of most organizations have this is the project that you would copy to start with.
Exactly. And it's all manual usually. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's either manual or it works from a template.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And Atomist makes it pretty easy to say, okay, we're going to, because it gives you a Slack command or a button in the web interface, both of those, to create a project from your starting point. And then you apply these little code transforms to do the obvious changes, you know, change the package name, change mm-hmm. the class name, change the, or if it's a node project, change the packet.json to point to the right things. Mm-hmm. So it does all those boilerplate stuff, but to a real project, not to a template.
Yeah.
So right. You can also have your boilerplate or your starting point project deployed if you want, and tests running on it and stuff like that. So that's a really easy one to get working immediately. You can also run it locally. Another interesting thing is, so you've got your software delivery machine, it runs locally on your laptop. Mm. And you can either have that doing CI for your organization on your laptop, which is great while you're testing. But you can also put it in local mode and it just listens to your local commits. Ooh, so yesterday on my stream, mm-hmm. when Rod and I were making a software delivery machine, that all it does is look at every push and see if you have any AWS keys exposed.
That's a great one. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. And that's the kind of thing you'd love to hear about that before you push.
Yeah.
If you run your software delivery machine in local mode, then it is doing the same CI processes on your laptop per commit.
Right.
And giving you little messages in a terminal window. Mm-hmm. And then separately, you can run it in like Kubernetes or whatever, your deployment environment, and have it do CI on every push. So you could get that notification of, you just committed an AWS secret, and possibly even notice that and change it before you push and expose it at all.
That's pretty awesome. That's great.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah. So, what you're talking to me about?
Ooh. Okay.
Ooh, Mr. Cotta, go ahead. I gotta hear.
All right. Well, fully ET. One, I'm doing my keynote I forgot to change the name of whatever. And my keynote is about collective problem solving in music, art, science, and software. It's really awesome. It starts with opera and the Florentine Camerata. So opera, the music, mm-hmm. not the browser. And goes through.
I didn't think opera had a Florentine Camerata on it. What's the window for that? Yeah.
Yeah. And it goes through to like why I'm so excited to be in software today. And then I'm also doing, in the last session slot, Principles of Collaborative Automation, which is about making these automations that work with people and let people make the decisions. They don't try to be smarter than the people, just make their lives a lot easier and make it easier to do the right thing.
That's great. Looking forward to both of those. Are you last talk first day?
I am first. I'm opening
the opener,
opening keynote and closing session on the second day.
Cool. Mm-hmm. You're bookending the day, basically.
The conference.
Yeah.
The 2-day conference.
Oh, wait, are you opening the first day? Mm-hmm. Oh, so you are truly the complete bookend of the conference.
Yeah, which means I don't get to enjoy the conference at all because I'm always going to be stressed about
it. Yeah, I was going to say, you're prepping and prepping and prepping and prepping. And yeah, I know that feeling.
It's okay. I'll have done this one a couple times.
So where can people find your stuff? I see you're on at Jessitron, which is probably the coolest Twitter handle I've ever seen. It's great.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I love my Twitter handle at Jessitron, but I'm Twitch. I'm Jessitronica. That's my backup. Yeah, jessitron.com if you really want to reassure yourself that I am not a front-end developer.
Most people aren't good front-end developers. There's some, and they're really good at that, and I admire them because I don't do that very well either.
It's so hard. It's so hard. I'm trying to learn more front-end development.
There's a really good book. I don't know if I have it here. There's a couple of really good books on, like, you know, just presentation and design of, you know, talking about negative space and font choices and things like that. And I look at them and go, at some point I'll internalize this stuff, but, like, where's the designer?
I'm like, help. I can't even get the thing to be on the screen where I want it to be. I mean, I would only be more frustrated if I knew where it should be.
We're coming at
from the wrong
angle.
At least now I'm like, oh, it's on there. You can see it. It'll be fine.
Yep. Well, you know, it's funny because we're coming at it from the engineering angle, mm-hmm. right? And then the front end is really visual design. And it's more of a designer, artist, art layout.
Yeah, there's all these concepts that I don't understand. Oh, you're probably right. In the sense of, if we did get those concepts, then CSS would start to make more sense because we'd have context for these words.
Right. And I know people, you know, use BEM or whatever, the atomic design kind of, you know, basically larger to smaller pieces. CSS design philosophy is the big thing now. So you're building your small little atoms, so to speak, which is your, let's say it's your button or your widget, and then you put it together into some sort of like a molecule, which is kind of a, let's call that a, I don't know, a toolbar or something like that. And then you've got your, and it goes up in structure. And then, so the idea is each of your things kind of has CSS applied at a certain level, right?
Yeah.
That's some big thing that's going on right now. I've noticed that, like, there's a whole kind of running a visual style guide all the time concept that people are using. In that design space, and I've not yet run a project or worked on a project where that's like a big thing, but it seems to be, you know, I forget the name of this. Is it called Stylebook? That might be the one I've heard of, where people are doing that. Basically, you open the thing up and you've got this whole, all the different types of widgets and organisms and things that you built are all there. You can click in each one and grab it and take it and use the styles that are set up for it in your application. It's like a living style guide. I look at that and I go, someday, someday I'll internalize this stuff and I'll feel better about myself. But it is a whole different part of the world in development.
It is. And it's really, we don't appreciate how different it is from imperative programming or functional, whatever, telling a computer what to do versus, please explain the relationships between these things on the screen so that I, the browser, can figure out a good way to solve this problem for you.
Right, right. And then visually, does this make sense to a user? Is it cohesive? Yeah. Does it stay together?
Yeah.
Is there a flow that makes sense, you know? Or is it just that you're a developer and you're thinking, I have these six operations to do, so I slap six operations on the screen. And I'm, well, it's obvious to me because I wrote the software, you know?
Right, right. Yes, that is one of the core problems of development right there, that we don't know how much we know and it's obvious to us and we can't see.
Yeah, our level of abstraction stops at, like, it functionally makes sense to me, or someone I'm describing it to, but then a user is like, I don't know what software is, help me out.
Yeah, or we get frustrated because we do know what software is, but damn it, we can't figure out yours.
I mean, you know, and the interface on a phone, it's like, you know, okay, there's only so much screen real estate. You know, you have to be really obvious about what you want to present to people. And You know, sometimes you look at an app that someone wrote and you can tell that's definitely a software developer engineer who has not thought about the visual design of what they're doing.
Yeah. Can't think about everything. It takes a team.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, really, you know, I can't feel bad about things I don't know. I can just appreciate that other people for knowing them. Yeah, yeah.
I just feel like that massive imposter syndrome from the JavaScript side, because you're living in the front end world. But then if you're not great at visual design, you should probably go hide. That's what I feel like. I'm like, I'm sorry.
This no, is no, no. We just leave it alone. We are important. We are not. We are necessary, but not sufficient.
Right. That's a good one. That's exactly right. All right, Jessica. So thank you so much for doing the podcast with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. We'll see you at ETE.
Yeah. It'll be awesome.
Many thanks again to Jessica Kerr for being our guest on the podcast and for speaking at Philly ETE. Again, her talks are called Collective Problem Solving, Music, Science, and Software, and Principles of Collaborative Automation. Look her up at the conference and let her know you heard about the talk via our podcast. You can find out more about her at jessatron.com. She also tweets frequently at @jessatron. The TechCast is also sponsored by Manning Publications. Chariot and Manning go way back. Many of our Philly emerging tech speakers are Manning authors, and several charioteers have reviewed Manning books for technical accuracy. Their In Action series is a great way to level up quickly in a given technology. That's why Manning has teamed up with Chariot to offer a discount code to TechCast listeners. Simply check out on their site with the code PODCHARIOT19, that's PODCHARIOT, and the number 19, all lowercase, and you'll get a whopping 40% off your next purchase. This discount is good for all TechCast listeners. For feedback on the TechCast, you can tweet us at TechCast or email us at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com. You can also comment on each episode on its show notes page. Our list of episodes is available at chariotsolutions.com/techcast, where you can also subscribe to the podcast via your favorite RSS reader. We're also available on iTunes. Please post a comment there to support our show. And that's it for this TechCast, hosted by Ken Rimple and produced by me, Becca Rufford. Until next time.